Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Caracas, Venezuela, to talk with Phil Gunson, who's a freelance journalist who writes for The Economist, Newsweek, and the Miami Herald. And Venezuela appears to be poised for civil war. Three people were shot yesterday at a rally, an anti-government rally. There's a general strike. The economy is in a tailspin. And we'll get a sense of whether this could break out into a serious civil war. And we'll also talk about the Iraqi government's release of its documentation, apparently over 10,000 pages of documentation, as to whether or not it has weapons of mass destruction. And apparently in this paper, this wad of paper, there is some indication that there's information about how to make weapons of mass destruction. So we'll be exploring, and apparently the UN have decided to withhold that for obvious reasons. So we'll talk with Gary Mulholland, the director of Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, about the what is possibly in these papers and how much they are a delaying tactic, if indeed they're full of information that would be helpful for two proliferators. And then we'll talk about the economy, which clearly President Bush is doesn't want to follow his father's fate, being a wartime president who has extraordinary popularity, but then is booted out of office because of a bad economy or a lack of attention to an economy. Since the White House is an entirely politically driven operation, this appears to be the reasons why the two top economic people were fired, the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chief Economist, Larry Lindsay, and Paul O'Neill. We'll be talking to Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, about the shakeup in Washington. And then towards the end of the program, we'll talk with John Wolfsthal, who's the Deputy Director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment. We're talking to him about the recent revelations that two key congresspeople are holding up efforts to help the Russia destroy its vast surpluses of nerve gas and nuclear materials. And of course, just recently, a group of Chechens took over a theater in Moscow, and it turned out that prior to taking over that theater, they had cased the Kurchatov Nuclear Research Institute. And so it's probably just a matter of time before some of the tons and tons of fissile material in the former Soviet Union is grabbed by somebody, and the U.S. is spending money to try and stop that, but this money is being held up by some cold warriors in the Congress who appear to be acting in a counterintuitive way. I'm speaking with Phil Gunson, who is in Caracas, Venezuela. And Phil, there was three people shot. I believe it was yesterday, or maybe the day before yesterday, with the time difference. But in any case, am I correct in characterizing Venezuela as being poised on the brink of some of civil war?
I think that might be putting it too strongly, but certainly I think there's a very serious danger that the violence could get out of control. Yes, the incident that you're referring to did happen on Friday. A gunman opened fire on a peaceful rally in a square that's been going on actually for about a month and a half, led by some dissident military officers. But despite the fact that they're there in their uniforms, and certainly some of them have sidearms, their protest has been peaceful. And it's not at all clear yet, and I suppose it may never be, exactly what was behind the shooting. Who hired the man who did the shooting, if indeed he was hired, or whether he acted entirely alone?
Well, I believe he identified on television at a pro-Chavez rally?
Well, that's one of the things that remains to be confirmed. It's certainly true that there is a video in existence dating from a couple of days before the shooting, in which the man or someone looking very like him is seen very close to a gentleman called Freddy Bernal, who's the mayor of one of the municipalities of Caracas, here, the Venezuelan capital, and the man who's a radical member of the president's own party and the leading, what they call here, the Taliban's, a leading supposedly involved in the arming of civilians and all sorts of plans to keep Chavez in power by whatever means necessary. The government, of course, has denied that there's any connection. In fact, they say that the government arrived in the country hours after the video was shot, so it can't possibly be the same man.
And these are the Bolivarian circles that they organise. Is that
That's right. I mean, that's the term that's usually used for them. The Bolivarian circles, for the most part, are what the government says they are. They're social organisations. I mean, they're kind of the grassroots of the government's political movement. Groups that get together mostly for purposes of maybe getting small loans from the government or getting some kind of equipment or becoming involved in some way or other with the government's political project. But small numbers of people on the government side, at least a minority certainly of government supporters, do appear to have been armed, whether within the framework of the Bolivarian circles or in some other way. Weapons have been distributed among civilians, and that's one of the serious concerns. It's possible, obviously, that if there were an attempt to get rid of Chavez, which was resisted by the civilians on his side, then there could be a lot of bloodshed in the streets.
Now, how come if this country's rift between the pro-government people, who are mostly the poor and the working class, I believe, in the slums of Caracas, and the anti-government protesters that have been going on for some time, there are the wealthy, the middle class, and the trade unions and the national oil company, etc., are all, and as you mentioned, retired military people, are all lined up against Chavez. How come the shooter is a Portuguese? And I believe they also arrested a British citizen as well. So is this situation attracting international freelancers?
Well, although the man concerned, the man who confessed to the shooting, was born in Portugal, he is actually a Venezuelan citizen. He also appears, to judge by the few statements that he's made and his reaction, for example, today when he was transferred from the police station to the court for an initial hearing, he appears to be mentally unstable. That doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that he acted alone. It could be that someone took advantage of that fact and gave him a gun and sent him off to do the shooting. The problem, of course, that we face is that in Venezuela it's very hard to find an independent investigative body to come up with the truth of any of these situations. We're still waiting to find out, for example, who was responsible or which groups were responsible for the killing of 19 people and the wounding of well over 100 in April on the previous occasion when Chavez was briefly ousted by the military.
Well, at this time, though, it's deteriorated because the economy's deteriorated. And now there's the national oil companies on strike, and I believe some of the Venezuelan flag tankers in the harbor are also on strike. And Chavez did make a very impassioned speech, I think it was yesterday, was it not, where he talked about the oil being the lifeblood and the nation's patrimony, and he denounced those that would try and restrict the life flow or the lifeblood of the country. And characterize that speech, if you will, and the reaction to it.
Well, the speech, the word that I've been using in writing about it is defiant. The speech was very much the speech of a man who, at the very least, was going to go down fighting. And in fact, of course, Chavez has never conceded that he's going to go down. In fact, he, quite the reverse, he says that whereas they caught him off guard in April, they're not going to do so again, that he now has total control of the military, that he's backed by the majority of the population, and that was a firecracker, incidentally. If listeners heard that one, it wasn't a gunshot. Yeah. And that he's entrenched in power and has no intention of calling early elections, which is what the opposition wants. The speech was, to many people, blood-curdling. A friend of mine who's lived here for a long time said that in 20 years of living here, he'd never felt so frightened as he did while watching Chavez give that speech. But it may be that it was a calculated speech in the sense that Chavez may know that the end is at hand, and he wants to, at the very least, give his negotiators a strong hand in negotiating perhaps the best way out for him. There are different theories, and of course most of them depend on analyzing the president's state of mind, which is speculation at best.
Well, again, let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Phil Gunson, who's a freelance journalist who writes for The Economist, Newsweek, and the Miami Herald, who's in Caracas, Venezuela, and talking about the extent to which the country is poised for some further... it's incredibly polarized. There have been shootings. Apparently, the firearms are all over the place. It's a sort of the National Rifle Association's poster child in terms of handgun proliferation, isn't it?
That's right. Well, yeah, Venezuelans have always liked to carry guns, and I was amazed when I first came to live here about 4 years ago, the kinds of people who do carry guns, who regularly carry guns as a matter of course, and that's got worse, certainly, in two ways, or three ways, really. One is that more criminals are armed these days, there's much more violent crime, and criminals are much more inclined to shoot anybody who resists a robbery, for example. That's one of the things that's happening. But in the political sense, as I say, the government or people associated with the government have undoubtedly been distributing weapons among their supporters. And on the other side of the equation, the opposition, after the events of April, which scared particularly the middle class a great deal, many people in middle-class areas of the city started arming themselves, getting weapons training, and also consulting security experts and retired military officers as to the best way to defend their properties if government supporters came to get them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me try and get a picture of Chavez and why the people hate him so, in or at least half the population, and on conversely, why his supporters are so fiercely loyal. When he first was elected by a pretty substantial popular mandate, I think, was it 1994?
98. Was
90, sorry, 98.
He was elected.
Yeah, 98. Yeah, but prior to that, he'd been involved in a coup attempt and was jailed. But he, I remember when he came into power that the LA Times and the New York Times both had very, very stinging editorials about him, as though somebody in the government had told them what a terrible guy he was. And I never quite understood whether he is this terrible guy that the editorials seemed to indicate, or he's just a sort of an ideological blowhard who likes to hang out with Castro. You know, I mean, what's what is he truly this frightening revolutionary that caused the editorial writers such panic, or is he just, you know, a sort of rhetorical loose cannon?
Well, he, first of all, it's worth pointing out that he's extremely charismatic. He's a man who, when he came to power after the 1998 elections, had well over 80% support among the population. That's to say, many people who didn't even vote for him were very optimistic that his government could do what he promised to set out and do, which was to end corruption, improve the economy, you know, make inroads on the terrible poverty in Venezuela. Those promises have proven to be false. He's not, in the past 3 years, he's succeeded in making the economy a good deal worse. The economy has shrunk overall since Chavez took power. By most reckonings, the poor are worse off, certainly in terms of the purchasing power of their salaries, than they were before. Corruption is rampant. None of the people from the regime that he replaced, which was a kind of a two-party system in decline, which had really run out of steam.
And that had been responsible. The political establishment in Venezuela really sort of deserved what they got, didn't they? Because since the 20s, they've been pumping all this oil, and it hasn't the revenues haven't been distributed fairly, and there was a tremendous entrenched kind of corruption, wasn't there, on the part of some of the ruling parties?
There's undoubtedly been an enormous amount of corruption, and it's to some extent inevitable in a country which suddenly becomes oil rich, as Venezuela did, particularly as from the first oil price shock in the early 1970s. And doesn't have strong enough institutions to control corruption. Corruption's certainly been a major factor, but I think it's wrong to suggest that corruption is the underlying problem, as Chavez sometimes seems to do. There's a prevailing myth among Venezuelans that this is a really rich country, and that if only everybody had their fair share, everybody'd have a condo in Miami and a yacht in the Bahamas. The fact is that if you actually divided up Venezuela's daily oil earnings among the population, everybody would get less than $2 a day. So it isn't true that there's a huge amount of wealth waiting to be distributed. And that's one of the myths that Chavez has helped preserve, unfortunately, and one of the reasons why the population remains so divided for and against. The middle class, who tend to be more educated, tend to see through him. But his charisma and his promises of revolution still have a hold among the poorer and less educated sectors of society. I think it's unfair probably to posit this just in terms of a class struggle. It's not simply a rich-poor battle. The opinion polls are pretty unanimous in giving the opposition around 70% of the vote, and Chavez maybe 25 to 30. And if you look at the social breakdown, it's clear that Venezuela is very largely poor. It's not 80% poor, as tends to be suggested, but certainly the poverty experts here say perhaps 65% of the population lives in poverty. So if there's a 70% disapproval rating, to put it that way, for Chavez, then clearly a lot of poor people are very dissatisfied with what he's done.
Well, just in closing then, Phil Ganson, what is going to... obviously, this is deteriorating into some kind of showdown, and this has been going on for years now, the demonstrators and the counter-demonstrators aren't going to stop. The economy is getting worse, particularly because of the oil boycott, and they're not shipping oil now. And of course, the opposition have called for a referendum. It seems as though they've changed their tune now, and they just want Chavez out. So, give me a sense of what's likely to happen in terms of like we had last time.
It's important to realize that historically, Chavez, who of course is a former military officer, a former lieutenant colonel from the army, he sees, and he said this on a number of occasions, he sees politics as an extension of war. He sees political battles as real battles, and he genuinely thinks that he's engaged in a final battle, if you like, between good and evil, between the Glorious Revolution and the reactionaries, and as he calls them, terrorists and coup mongers and fascists is another term that he uses. So he thinks he's engaged in this final showdown, which he believes, at least he professes to believe, he's going to win. That makes things very dangerous because historically, the only two occasions on which he's actually backed down in the face of political opposition or opposition of any kind has been when he's been faced with a superior military force. And that's the danger. I think many people feel that he actually would prefer a military coup against him because at least that would allow him to preserve this myth that he's the representative of the people who's been defeated and deposed by an evil fascist plot.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us from Caracas, Venezuela, Phil Ganson.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking then with Phil Ganson, who's a freelance journalist in Caracas, Venezuela. He writes for The Economist, Newsweek, and the Miami Herald, among other publications. I'm now speaking with Gary Mulholland, who's the director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. And Gary, you're... the what 10,000 plus pages have just been released from the Iraqi government. They came in early on the deadline, but apparently a lot of this stuff has got to be translated and the language is kind of florid. But I also understand that in the body of this, at least Hans Blix said yesterday at a press conference that there's some information in there that would be helpful or would be dangerous to be released to the public because it describes what the ingredients are in nerve gas and other weapons of mass destruction. So what's going on here is, are the Iraqis putting this stuff in there just to slow the process down, or what do you think?
Well, it seems to me that there are probably two motives. First, they'd like to be able to say that they have disclosed everything they've ever done. And second, they would also like to slow the process down because their strategy now is to play for delay. By putting in cookbooks for making various kinds of weapons, nerve gas or nuclear weapons or, for example, nuclear bomb design, they've put the West, in particular in the United States, in a kind of a curious position because it's kind of awkward for us to accuse them of having revealed too much when we've been criticizing them for not revealing enough. Yet, on the other hand, if this goes to the Security Council as it's been submitted, countries like Syria, which are now Syria is a member of the Security Council, could get a big boost in its own weapon efforts by what it could learn from these pages. So I think Mr. Blix has done the right thing. He stated that he's not going to turn this over until he's had a chance to go through it and take out any information that could be helpful to countries trying to make weapons of mass destruction.
And what is the timeline here now? Because as these papers have been delivered, the White House, both President Bush and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld have made clear in advance that they don't buy anything that comes out of Saddam Hussein. And meanwhile, they're making preparations for war, major exercises in Kuwait, and the bases in Qatar are being built up. So give us a sense of the timeline now. How long is it going to take them to go over these papers? And when does the UN issue its report? And obviously, I don't think the United States is going to jump the gun and go to war before the UN finishes. Even if they think it's meaningless theater and they have disdain for the process, they still can't preempt the process, can they, the United States?
Well, it's very awkward to do that. but, you know, if at some point Saddam makes a mistake, that is, if the inspectors find something that prove he's been lying, or that we suddenly discover that there's been a development somewhere, or we intercept a shipment going in, or a defector suddenly comes out, that could short-circuit the process. But just assuming that nothing unusual happens, what's going to take place now probably is that it's going to take a while to digest this giant morsel that the Iraqis have just put on the table. It has to be submitted after it's sanitized for the Security Council. Then it will go to the members, including the United States. At that point, the United States will send it out to the U.S. intelligence agencies for analysis. That's going to take some time. Then it'll come back, and then the Bush administration will make some kind of a declaration concerning what it thinks about this document. My guess is that they'll say that it leaves out important things, that it doesn't answer important questions, that some of the information in it is wrong. That's just a guess, but that's been the pattern in the past. That is, every time Iraq has filed one of these declarations, it's been both incomplete and misleading, and also wrong in just in particulars. So unless there's something really unusual about this latest one, I think we can expect the same thing to happen. But after that, it's unclear what goes down next. The inspectors are supposed to go around and verify what the Iraqis have said. They won't be able to prove that the Iraqis are lying unless we give them some fresh intelligence information. And I think it's still unknown whether the U.S. government is going to decide to do that or not.
And what kind of timeline are we talking about? Say, for example, for when the inspectors get the go-ahead to go out and check and verify what's in these documents.
Well, they can.
That'd be mid-January, wouldn't it?
I don't think that long, but I think we have to assume that it's going to take probably a couple of weeks at least for the United States to go through this stuff after we get it, and it could be up to a week before we get it. So we're probably looking at the end of this month before we're going to have a declaration by the Bush administration about what it thinks concerning this document. And then in January, the inspectors can continue their work. Of course, they're going to continue to go to sites and do inspections in the meantime. But I would think that January is going to bring some kind of I think it probably things will come to a head in January. That's my guess.
And it's always been supposed that what is driving the U.S. War effort, if that's what it is, is the weather, right? That it starts to get hot in February, and if you're in a chemical and anti-chemical weapons suit, you're just toast. So Is this where the sort of window is narrowing here? Is it truly all about the weather?
I don't think it is. People I've discussed this with, generals, have said that the weather is not the governing factor. If it's hot, chemical weapons get burned up in the heat, and so do biological weapons, although it's harder to operate in the suits. So the weather cuts both ways. I think that given the momentum now and the buildup of military forces, if Bush wants to go to war, if President Bush wants to go to war, he's not going to be able to keep all these people just cycling in place for a year. He's going to have to make a decision January, February about whether to go. And I think it's probably going to be January rather than February. And I think that it's unlikely the Iraqis are going to do what they would have to do, which is actually come clean and reveal all of their programs. So what we're doing now is I think, just watching a process of information, inspections, and so forth, which are going to lead us to some point at which it's going to become somebody's going to decide, probably the Bush administration, that the Iraqis have not come clean. And then the question is, what are we going to do about it?
Well, the Iraqis have already indicated, Tariq Aziz has already indicated in his interview with Ted Koppel, that he expects war, and he thinks the whole thing's a farce and a fraud on the part of the U.S. government, that they really are determined to go to war and take his oil, etc. But they're a strange bunch, the Iraqis, because at least Saddam is, because he believes, and he's told the Iraqi people that they won the last war. I mean, so what is their idea of a victory, and what is their idea of defeat? I mean, it's almost like they're you know, not welcoming the war, but certainly resigned to it.
I think they are resigned to it, and that's probably a realistic position. But it's not. I don't think this all is. These inspections are a charade. I think they are what Secretary Powell said they are. They're really giving Saddam a last chance to reveal his programs. Because if he did that, the inspections could actually work. That is, they could actually go out and verify what he has. If they were led to sites, if they were given computer programs that explained the entire weapon effort, if they were allowed to interview all the scientists or their key ones without fear of retaliation.
Well, now that apparently Hans Blix vetoed that, taking the key scientists out of the country.
I think he's going to have to. That's a problem he's going to have to solve, because that's a quick way to determine who's telling the truth, is to get the scientists in a position where they can't tell the truth. And since he has the power to take them out of the country, and he has the power to take their families out of the country, I think what he has to do is sit down and figure out how many scientists he needs, whether there are scientists who are willing to leave, whether there are scientists who are willing to leave and who don't have big family obligations. And if he can come up with a critical mass of scientists, then I think he might be able to actually discover the truth fairly quickly. And I don't think over the long run the administration here, the Bush administration, is going to accept the argument that Mr. Blix just doesn't want to do that. I think he's going to have to figure out some way to solve that problem.
But it's so clear, though, from the rhetoric from the Bush administration, which has been going on for some time now, that they have the president has talked about regime change there, and it's I don't think there's much mystery that that's his intention, isn't it? I mean, so to that extent, I suggest that there's a theatrical component here, because If he declares it and the UN says it's okay, you still get the impression that this administration won't be satisfied with anything less than a regime change. And I suspect one of the things that they're doing in terms of piling on this pressure and deploying all these troops is they're hoping that by putting on this pressure that the regime's going to crack from within.
Yes, I think that's a fair position. I think the statement that the United States won't settle for anything less than regime change undermines the U.S. position that what we really want to do is disarm Saddam. You can't have it both ways. And if Saddam did comply with his obligations under Resolution 687 and disarmed, then I don't think there would be a basis for regime change, other than the fact that he's obviously a humanitarian disaster and he's obviously holding back the aspirations of his own people. But that's a different question. And if you're going to war, you're going to take the American people to war, and we will, because we're going to have to activate over 200,000 reserves. That's going to affect a lot of people. You're going to have to give a clear message to the country about why it is you're going, why it's necessary, and what you hope to achieve. And so I think it's difficult for the administration to have it both ways, to have both regime change and disarmament as a basis for going to war.
So, and the poor beleaguered Iraqi people who have been have suffered under this horrendous dictatorship for over 20 years, and have suffered under UN sanctions for over a decade. There's just no end in sight. You know, it's either going to be more suffering or a war.
Yes, and even if there's a war, if there's not a war, there's going to be more suffering. Obviously, I can't imagine that the embargo is going to be lifted with some finding that Saddam is disarmed. I don't think that's in the cards. So the Iraqi people have to look forward to more of what they have now, or a war in which they would obviously suffer during the war, and then an uncertain future after the war. I think the best hope for the Iraqi people is that if there is a war, that the conditions rapidly improve, and that's a task that is easier said than done.
Yeah, well,
that's running in Afghanistan.
Well, that's the scenario that a couple of weeks ago, Yusuf Ibrahim, the veteran New York Times Middle East correspondent, who was in Basra during the 91 war, and saw what happened inside Iraq when President Bush called upon the people to rise up against Saddam and witnessed them being slaughtered. And he basically say, you know, maybe a six-day war, but on the seventh day, that's when the problems begin. That's when you have the two Kurdish factions, the Sunni and the Shia, and you're trying to, mediate between that. Plus, you'll have all this vengeance that'll be going on because of every family has lost somebody to Saddam's wars or to the Mujahideen. And so they'll be seeking vengeance, and the Tikrit clan will be slaughtered, and the Special Republican Guards will be slaughtered, etc. So that's the victory is the beginning of the disaster, by the sound of it.
Well, I think that's... It could be, but on the other hand, it could not be. I think it is very hard to know. But I'm a little concerned that the United States doesn't seem to have a clear plan for avoiding disaster. That is, I think there's a good chance for disaster if we don't have a clear notion of what it is we're going to do as soon as the last shot is fired. And I think we're still working on that. And if there's some time between now and the time this inevitable war comes, I hope we'll put it to good use and think about what it is we're going to do after the war to prevent more suffering by the Iraqi people.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Gary Mulholland.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Gary Mulholland, who's the director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. I'm now speaking with Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And Heather, this week there was a major shuffle in the White House. They fired the top economic team of Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and Chief Economist Lawrence Lindsay. And the White House has sort of managed to put out unpleasant news at propitious moments. For example, the firing of Harvey Pitt on the very night that the election returns were coming in. So this one they seem to have bitten the bullet on. The indications are that the White House is tightly run by Karl Rove, the political advisor, and that not one move is made without his fingerprints. So is this Karl Rove recognizing what they have to do to win in 2004?
I think this is definitely about what they have to do to win in 2004. I think it was an interesting time for them to choose to fire these two. I'm sure you've seen the reports that have come out that they wanted to wait a day or two before they announced it publicly, but Paul O'Neill evidently left his office and made a public announcement very soon after being fired. So in some sense, they didn't have as tight a control over that firing as they wanted to.
Well, you can't fire him twice.
Right, this is true. And you can't control what somebody does after you fire them. I think it was an interesting time to do it. The unemployment numbers come out the first Friday of every month, and over the past few months, economists have been watching these numbers very closely because the unemployment rate had been falling. However, what was very interesting about it was that employment had actually been falling as well. And so it seemed rather odd that unemployment had not fallen yet, and many people expected unemployment to rise this Friday, which, of course, it did. It rose all the way up to 6%, which was a 3.3 percentage point increase, which is rather large. And so it was not, I think, a good day for them to announce firings in there on their economic team, because we also had this bad economic news coming out at us. But reading the papers over the past couple of days, it does seem that the loss of the leadership on the economic team has overshadowed to some degree what's actually going on in the economy.
Yeah, but what's going on in the economy seems to be completely separate from everything that's ever come out of this administration and still continues to come out of this administration, plus the Republican-controlled House and Senate. All they talk about is tax cuts. Do they have any plans beyond tax cuts and privatizing Social Security?
Yeah, they don't seem to. From all indicators, from things that they've said and the reports that come out, it seems like that is their major economic plan, is more tax cuts, accelerating the tax cuts, increasing the tax cuts, and even they're talking about eliminating the personal income tax in favor of a national sales tax, or what Europeans have, a value-added tax. So that does seem to be their one economic policy that they've had consistently throughout this administration. It seems to be their only plan. Meanwhile, for working Americans and families all across the country, there are many economic issues and things that are affecting them right now that the administration has been ignoring. I think one of the most important is, of course, the relatively high unemployment, and the fact that typically when unemployment is this high, Congress has moved in the past, over past decades, to increase the amount of time that someone can receive unemployment insurance compensation while they're unemployed. So as unemployment is higher and it takes longer for people to find new jobs, they extend the time that you can receive these benefits. However, this administration has not moved to extend unemployment benefits right now, and in fact, over 800,000 people will lose their benefits as of December 28th, which is, of course, not a very nice Christmas gift for people. And this is something that would really affect families, and Bush's economic team has ignored it. They seem to be very far removed from things that actually affect most Americans.
Well, it's not just the Bush's economic team in the White House. It's also this fellow from down here in Bakersfield, who's the head of the House of Ways and Means Committee, Thomas, who's clearly they're just mean-spirited. I mean, the Congress, and at the same time as they're cutting off unemployment benefits, which I don't think has ever happened before. I don't think any administration, Republican or Democrat, has ever been quite that nasty. They managed to, in the lame duck session, to indemnify insurance companies against losses from acts of terrorism. So they took care of the insurance lobby and then stiffed the working people.
Yes, they definitely did. You know, the Senate did pass a bill to extend unemployment insurance benefits prior to going home for their break, but it was Congress, you're right, the House, who chose not to extend these benefits. And this is true, this is the first time in a period of high unemployment that Congress has refused to extend unemployment insurance benefits. And it is unclear to me whether or not they are simply mean-spirited, or whether they just don't see the severity of the situation, or if they're so wrapped up in what's going on here in Washington, they can't really see how people are hurting around the country and how they need help. And really, what is interesting about this particular policy is that by putting money in unemployed people's hands, by giving them some benefits, this actually helps to stimulate the economy overall and keep people spending, especially because you want them to keep spending through the holiday season. So it's short-sighted in that it's mean-spirited, but it's also just bad economic policy in general.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And just in terms of a political opposition, which, you know, clearly the recent elections indicated that the Democratic base didn't show up, and I think most Democrats in this country appear to be disappointed in their party and its lack of focused leadership and political courage. But on the other hand, you can't help thinking to yourself, well, what's wrong with them? Because look at all the issues. And unless the American people are so babbitized to death by the Chamber of Commerce and relentless advertising that they don't they just think that if things aren't going well, it's their fault. I just can't believe that there has to be some vestiges of fairness in the country, and people have to. I mean, the unemployment benefit, not letting the unemployed get the benefits that they normally get, going after Social Security, which and putting that into the stock market after you've seen what happened to the 401ks when they used to have conservatively held pension plans, then they let the employers assign somebody to manage it, usually somebody from the brokerage business. We've seen what's happened to the 401ks. They jokingly referred to the 201ks. We've seen what's happening to the tax fairness issue, not just giving away taxes to the rich, but they want to make those cuts permanent, and they want to give more cuts for
wealthier families.
And also on dividends and other things that Wall Street's asked for. And then you look at the average person's pay package. Payroll taxes are, I think, about 40% of government revenues now. So people are being punished for working, for having a job. I mean, everything about the way that the tax burden is distributed in this country seems so flagrantly unfair. And furthermore, you don't get anything back for your taxes. All you get is a strong military. You don't get any health care. You don't get any of the benefits that the rest of the civilized world has. So I shouldn't say that term, rest of the civilized world, but the rest of the Western democracies. You know. Well, so here I am ranting, but why don't you just weigh in and
I think
stop
me? I think it's an important rant. I mean, I don't think that people are getting, and we are seeing this administration, this Congress, giving more back to the wealthy than they've done for most working Americans. And the idea that people are paying taxes and not getting as much back is true. You know, one of the things that we're seeing over the past, since the economic downturn started, is a real crisis in the states out there in terms of budget crises. This is happening all across the country. And it's the states that provide many of the services that all of us use every day. It's the states that provide us with education and roads and transportation systems and provide a lot of the health care. And the fact that the administration has also not stepped in to help meet the deficits for the states is also another way that they're not helping most working families and most Americans. So another way that they're ignoring some of the real pressing policy issues. Education has become a really big one, as many of the states have looked at the Bush education plan as an unfunded mandate because they have not allocated the kinds of money that the states need to provide the upgrades to the educational system that the Bush education plan was supposed to do. So in many ways, they are really ignoring what's going on for most families in the ways that we could both be helping families and helping the economy grow. I think that one of the outcomes of all of this in somewhat a different way, but we're all very concerned as to, you know, how much people will be spending over the next few weeks during the holiday season, and whether or not things will start looking up over the course of the winter. But because the administration has not been acting, I think that's highly unlikely.
Well, I understand that consumer debt is what's holding the economy up, and you've as just pointed out that there's also a hidden cost here to the fact that as unhealthy as the federal budget is with deficit spending, the states are in much, much worse shape. But just in terms of what drives the economy, I understand that it is consumer debt, and the American consumer seems to be the most heroic in the world. The Japanese don't consume like the Americans do, I don't know how many more gaps we need and how many more malls we need. But the other thing I believe that's happening is that because of low interest rates, people are refinancing.
Yeah.
But I understand also the majority of the people who refinance their houses, they take that money out and they consume that money as opposed to cutting down on their monthly payments. And I think next year that ends, doesn't it?
Yes, well, a lot of them go out and buy home furnishings and new sofas and these sorts of things, which are, you know, good for the economy, but don't necessarily reduce that families' total debt burden. Now, the fact that consumer debt right now is almost, it's 109% of personal disposable income. So for the first time in since we've been tracking consumer debt, people actually are more indebted than they have an annual income on a regular basis. And one of the things that's been interesting to watch over this economic, it's not really, I wouldn't call it recovery just yet, but this nascent economic recovery has been that, unlike in previous recessions, where the government goes into deficit to help spur economic growth, this time around it's been consumers who've gone into deficit spending through taking on debt in order to keep the economy moving. When you look at the numbers that come out in terms of economic growth, it is being driven by and large by consumer spending, so that it's really individuals who've taken up this responsibility, as it were, to help keep the economy moving, and the government, which has not taken up that responsibility in terms of stimulating demand.
Well, just to close then on a sort of political deck chair shuffling here, because that seems to be what the press is interested in, is who gets to replace the Treasury Secretary and possibly the Chief Economist, Larry Lindsay, who, by the way, I think wasn't his main sin, was he? He said that the new Gulf War is going to cost, we have these immaculate wars like the one in Bosnia where no American was killed, but, you know, immaculate is one thing, but wars still cost, even if you don't have suffered casualties, and clearly they won't be quite that lucky in Iraq, but still. Lindsay said it was going to cost up to $200 billion, and I think, wasn't that what did
it mean? The administration was very angry at that, by all accounts.
Uh-huh.
But it was interesting because it did spark a debate. You know, the first Gulf War, we actually didn't, the United States paid very little for because our allies helped out, which is not as likely this time around. And he claims that he said it to point out how small the cost would be relative to the overall national economy. But I think that number did scare a lot of Americans into wondering whether or not our economy could handle that.
Well, I understand that Karl Rove's favorite is Don Evans, the Texas oil man, who's the Commerce Secretary.
Yes.
There's also the possibility of Phil Gramm, has had, been somewhat discredited recently because of his wife's being on the Enron auditing board, and he was the guy that single-handedly held up efforts to curtail money laundering, and he doesn't have a stellar record, at least from my point of view.
Well, that hasn't stopped the administration from putting people in positions of power. There's Phil Gramm, there's Don Evans, Bill Archer out of Texas. And my understanding from reading the Washington Post this morning is that Stephen Friedman, the administration, has said that he's accepted the post to replace Lindsay, and that they'll be announcing that on Monday. He evidently worked with Robert Rubin at the former Treasury Secretary under Clinton, worked at Goldman Sachs with him. So,
the White House didn't need to turn to Wall Street because they had so much money from their donors, apparently. But this is a nod to Wall Street. Anyway, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us, Heather.
Well,
Boucher.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've just been there with Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm speaking now with John Wolfsthal, who is the Deputy Director of the Nonproliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. And, John, there was an article last Monday's Los Angeles Times, a front-page article, saying that a trove of Russian arms at risk. And we just witnessed recently in Moscow the Chechen rebels taking over a theater, holding about 700 people hostage, and we all know how dreadful the government's response was to that. But it does indicate that a country where there is literally tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of fissile material, and that's all that anybody needs to make a bomb nowadays. Apparently the knowledge is out there. You just can't get hold of this stuff. So isn't it just a matter of time before somebody grabs some of this stuff?
Well, we have grown, in my opinion, very complacent here in the United States and in the West. I do a lot of traveling in Europe as well, that because we have gone now a decade without a nuclear bomb finding its way out of former Soviet territory, that we must clearly be safe and this problem is handled. And the facts, unfortunately, prove that wrong. We are far from safe. There are huge amounts of nuclear material, nuclear know-how, chemical weapons, biological material that is still at risk in Russia and the former Soviet Union. And any day it could pop up to produce a disaster of unprecedented scale.
And for all of our focus on Saddam Hussein, if you were in Saddam Hussein's shoes and you were desperately trying to get a weapon of mass destruction, which apparently he's been doing, because it's pretty clear that he'd rather you know, not have, he'd rather could forego all that money to hold on to whatever it is he has. Wouldn't you want to go to Russia? I mean, wouldn't that be the obvious place for Saddam?
It not only would be the obvious place, but it's a place where we know that Iraqi agents and, for that matter, Iranian agents and North Korean agents have been very busy trying to get their hands on anything and anything, everything they can. It is amazing to me that in a world where the president every day and his cabinet every day talk about the dangers of proliferation and of terrorists acquiring weapons of mass destruction, and of focusing on countries like Iraq and Saddam Hussein, who clearly have an interest, that we aren't doing more and that we aren't doing as much as we can to prevent the number one potential source, Russia, of this material from becoming the supply agent for many of these states or subnational groups.
And what was revealed in the article last week by, in the Los Angeles Times was that the two congresspeople on the House Armed Services Committee, and the senior one, Kurt Weldon, along with Duncan Hunter, representative from down here near San Diego, are holding up the Nunn-Lugar account, which has been operating for some time, which is U.S. taxpayer money being targeted to increase security at these areas where all this stuff stockpiled, plus money to go to a plant to destroy these vast inventories of Soviet nerve gas. So what is their motive then? The article suggested that they were just conservative, sort of cold warriors who couldn't get used to this new you know, subnational, transnational landscape out there. But isn't the reason that taxpayers' dollars are spent on this stuff is that it's in the United States' interest to have this stuff neutralized or secured?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it's by no means just the efforts of two members of Congress. Weldon and Hunter are two very strong skeptics of these programs. But there are very few senators or congressmen that have made it their business to ensure that these programs get the money they need and the efforts they need, even though every day, every dollar spent is providing a direct national security benefit to the United States. And I would argue that more effective than huge portions of the defense budget, aside from salaries for our fighting men and women and essential equipment, we spend money for things in the defense budget that will never provide a real benefit to the U.S. And these are money spent that do. Some of the critics and that have opposed or complicated implementation of these programs, which cut up missiles and destroy chemical weapons, have said that they're concerned about the accounting or that they're worried that the Russians haven't been 100% honest about their declarations, how much chemical weapons they have, how many biological weapons they produced. They're also concerned that money being spent by the United States is money that the Soviet or the Russian military doesn't have to spend, and therefore we're indirectly subsidizing the Russian military budget. I would argue that all of those things, while they are concerns, pale in comparison to the risk that one artillery shell filled with chemical weapons will be stolen and find its way out of Russia. Each one of those shells could kill over 50,000 people, and there are over 1.5 million filled shells at a facility at Zuche in Russia, which is awaiting destruction, but the U.S. money simply hasn't been spent quickly enough and effectively enough yet.
I understand that while the government's dragging its heels and that these congresspeople and I believe the Assistant Secretary of State, Bolton, as well, is dragging his heels, a lot of concerned Americans have stepped in, Warren Buffett and Ted Turner, the the billionaires are stepping up to the plate. I mean, isn't the government a little embarrassed?
Well, you would think that a government would be concerned that private citizens have to step in and fill the void that the government is unwilling or unable to fill. Unfortunately, for this administration, or from our point of view, this administration isn't really a very strong supporter of these programs. Witness the fact that President Bush was just in St. Petersburg, meeting with President Putin in Russia 2 weeks ago, and nothing about these programs, the need to accelerate them, the need to do more, the need to get more effective implementation, was mentioned in their meeting. During the Clinton administration, just for example, every time the president met, this was on the top of the agenda. The vice president used to meet with the prime minister of Russia twice a year, specifically to accelerate implementation of these programs. So you would think that this would come back to haunt the administration, that people like Warren Buffett and Ted Turner have to spend out of their own pockets what the U.S. government and taxpayers should be ponying up for. So far, at least, it hasn't come back to haunt them. It hasn't really been an issue in voters' minds or in the public's minds. And God forbid, the only way that it really will come back to haunt them is when something terrible happens and the American public asks, well, why didn't we do more to protect these materials?
It's just that when you look at the scope of the problem, and can you give me a figure on how much plutonium and U-235 is there?
Well, I can give you a figure, but it'll be a general estimate. The problem is that even the Russians themselves don't know exactly how much material. That's part of the problem, that it's not, even 10 years later, not fully accounted for. But Russia produced on the order of 1,300 to 1,400 metric tons of nuclear material, plutonium and highly enriched uranium. It's enough material for over 100,000 nuclear weapons, each one of which is larger than the one that destroyed Hiroshima.
And we've just seen the Chechens taking a theater, and I understand that they cased the Kachatov Institute prior to that, where there are a number of research reactors and a lot of fissile material, right?
Well, that's right. And for those of us that work on these issues, the theater standoff and the murders and the disaster that followed really reinforced just how dangerous a world or just how dangerous a situation we find today in Russia, where you don't have full control of the population, where groups can travel with arms almost at will, even in Moscow, and in a world where you have nuclear reactors, nuclear materials, radioactive fuel, nuclear waste, all of which vulnerable to infiltration, any day could bring a disaster of unprecedented scale.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, John Wolfstahl.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking there with John Wolfstahl, who's the Deputy Director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You can reach me at Ian Masters, one word, ianmasters@mail.com.